Hi, I'm Helen Black, and my award-winning novel, Seven Blackbirds, is now available in audiobook format. There's a brief excerpt on the Amazon product page that you can click on and listen to, and I also wanted to make you the gift of a longer excerpt so that you could get more of a taste of my writing, my reading, the characters, places, scenes, conversations. It's 9 tiny snippets, runs about 12 minutes. I really enjoyed putting it together, and I hope you enjoy listening. Thank you. After a while, he began to ignore me completely. He worked out, he wound up with his few remaining portfolio companies, took his laundry to the cleaners, went shopping for his advance move to the West Coast. I convinced myself that when I felt better, he would too, and I thought I'd seen it begin to happen. I remembered the exact moment. It was the day in week 15 when I started holding down flatbread crackers one at a time. Larry walked in the door with a bag of peaches from the farmer's market. He handed me one and smiled when I bit into it. That was the Larry I wanted to believe in, the Larry who handed me a peach and smiled. That's the one I had to believe in. I could not allow myself to think a pregnancy had been a mistake. That was one mental file I wouldn't open. There was still time for Larry to grow into fatherhood. There was still time. I could still taste that peach. I held on to that peach. It was a miracle. The streets of Hubbard Woods were hard as iron and bleached with salt. Karen and I crunched silently toward Lake Michigan, breathing painfully even through scarves. I could just see the tips of my boots bobbing alternately from beneath my red wool-clad belly. He hasn't told his parents yet. He hasn't told his parents yet. Karen took my arm. I can't believe that coat still fits you. I was just thinking that. Uptown there were few cars on the street, and the stores were closed except for both delis and the coffee shop, windows completely fogged up. We crossed Green Bay and stopped on the train tracks, arm in arm, looking first all the way south toward Chicago, then all the way north to Milwaukee, drinking in the long stretch into bleak distances. We'd always done this, as girls out of curiosity and longing, but since we'd grown up and moved away, had occasion to live in places that were not flat, we discovered that what we actually craved was, simply, that ability to see for a distance. It was something we'd had and taken for granted, but now desperately needed in order to feel we had a clear grip. The world was no longer so mysterious, but a good deal more complicated. At the end of the street, we stood beneath naked trees on the bluff overlooking the beach. A wedge of frozen whitecaps rimmed the sand, buffering it from waves angry with wind as far as the eye could see. "So," Karen said finally, "remind me. If you're not moving to Seattle now, how are you going to make sure Larry is there when the baby is born?" "So," Mr. Duncan smoothed his hands over his desktop, a large expanse of burled walnut completely empty save for a blotter and a tiny bronze statuette of a bronco buster just managing to stay in the saddle. Mr. Duncan was balding, with a long nose and full lips, a big man, but he carried it well, and a fastidious dresser. His shirt had enough starch in it to withstand a gale force, and he wore a silver bar in his rep tie, an old-fashioned touch that reminded me of my dad. After a moment he drew a yellow pad toward him and uncapped a fountain pen. "I take it you want to file for divorce?" I nodded. His suit jacket hung on a coat tree in the corner. Not draped, but on a proper hanger. This attention to detail was reassuring. He started asking questions, and I watched his hand move down the yellow pad. Name, address, where and when we'd married. No joint property except the bungalow, which was already under contract. One child born on such and such a date. He doesn't want custody, I assured him. He's totally uninterested in the baby. He looked up at me, then down. Flipped to the next yellow page. There was one failed attempt to join a group, women about my age, but they'd just discovered they were all Georgetown law grads and were busy trading restaurant names. When they found out I hadn't even started law school, and even worse, was enrolled someplace in Oklahoma, they cut me out, even though I was the bride's sister-in-law. When Suzanne, in an ivory silk shantung suit, joined us and began to reassure her friends that the 2-carat solitaire on her finger was just a starter ring, I skulked off and hung out near the harpist. I wanted to tell those women, I only came to this wedding because I had to, and the only reason I'm going to school in Oklahoma is because Larry wouldn't let me apply anywhere east of the Mississippi because he couldn't wait to get away from the family that your girlfriend is so desperate to ditch as well that she's marrying a cripple who went to NYU at night, and who you're only looking at twice because he's now assistant general counsel at a major New York publishing house and wears suspenders. And in the Midwest, women don't necessarily wear black to weddings, even if they're in the evening. But of course I didn't. And he wasn't really a cripple. He'd only lost 2 fingers off one hand at a petting zoo as a child. The nurse came back into the examination room, a freckly redhead living in the wrong climate. She was holding a miniature straitjacket. "No," I said. "Now, honey." She smiled at me, which only added yellowing teeth to the equation. I was not in the mood to be charitable. It was the end of a busy day, including an exam, a deli sandwich from Bigelow's, a nap in the car, and a trip down to the restraining order office. While Trey had made it quite clear to his client that he couldn't see Nathan until the testing was completed, I wasn't taking any chances. Larry had been leaving flight times on my answering machine. So I joined a dozen women scattered along 3 tables stacked with forms and tissue boxes and dutifully filled in the blanks. I was so drained I didn't mind that I knew the supervising attorney, Suli, a former classmate, didn't mind being walked across the street into the courthouse, didn't mind being lined up against the wall outside the courtroom. All that mattered was that I now had in my pocket a document stamped by order of the court of Tulsa County, Oklahoma. The medical lab on Skelly Drive was our last jolly stop of the day. "No," I said again, rubbing the band-aid in the crook of my elbow. "Honey, it's the only way to take a blood sample from a baby. They're just too squirmy." She took him from me and strapped him in. She had on a WWJD wristband. What would Jesus do? "Now you hold his head this way so he can't see what I'm doing." I crooned to Nathan, stroking his hair. "We've had shots before, sweet pumpkin baby. This'll only take a minute. Then you'll have a treat." He started to wail. "Can't find a vein," the nurse said. "Don't worry, we'll get it. They're just so small." She tried again, and again, and again. Nathan's face turned purple. The nurse gave me a quick apologetic glance, brushing back a loosened wisp from her forehead with her wrist. "Those veins are so small." "Just do it!" I screamed. "Let's take a break for a minute, hon." I bent down, stroked his cheek, kissed his damp forehead. Behind me, the nurse opened the door. "Get the mother out of here," she hissed. "Sweet Jesus," he said again. "This is my lucky night." "It is if you've got some condoms." I liked the way he held me tight. I wanted his arms around me. I needed a warm body as much as he did, if not more, to keep the ghosts at bay. In the Quick Trip parking lot, I sat and watched him make his way through the bright fluorescent aisles like a man driven. I took a sip from the flask, then propped my chin on my hand and closed my eyes. A cool breeze fanned across my face. When I opened them, a skinny cowboy in a pearl-buttoned shirt stood in front of me. "Jesus has your answer." His voice had such a lilt I waited, thinking it might be the first line of a song. "Jesus has your answer," he said again. I took my chin out of my hand and gave him my best smile. "Well, that's just dandy. Thank you so much." He tipped his hat and walked away. He led me to his office and cleared a chair. After the obligatory initial chat, one cigarette in duration, he swiveled around to the credenza, picked up 3 files, and handed them to me. "What kind of cases are these?" I asked. He laced his hands behind his head. 3 med-mal cases just got dropped into my lap. I don't really have the time, but I thought you might be interested. If you did some research, we might be able to address them together. "They are, of course, contingency," he said, as though in afterthought. "How much would you be paying me?" "These are contingency cases," he repeated, busying himself with his lighter. "We'd work out a split, but I wouldn't be paid for them until settlement, assuming we were successful." "In other words, you want me to do all this work without being paid for it." He tapped ash into one of the trays wedged around his desk. "That's what contingency means." I looked down at the files in my lap. It had taken me the entire morning to get ready for this appointment, to wash my hair, dress decently, apply hairspray and mascara, and suck down enough coffee to hold a pen without dropping it. In other words, to successfully assume the disguise of a normal functioning human being. All in those spare moments between feeding, changing, playing with, feeding and changing a very active baby boy. Brian didn't have any work to contract out. He just wanted to make a buck off me at no risk to himself. I thought of my cello again, remembered what it was like to hold the instrument in the crook of my thumb and among the infinity of scale tones on wire-wrapped catgut find just the right ones, then reach with the little finger a gentle breath, not a pressure, for the harmonic, the single delicate place on each string where the tone was a ghostly whisper containing within it echoes of the lower octaves. Harmonics are shadows. Shadows thrown back by the future or forward by the past to the place where time meets timelessness, that seamless junction, eternity. But art can be perfect. Real life can't. I'd given up one and stumbled at the other. And as I moved further and further into adulthood, shifted from theory to practice, I'd accumulated moments I wouldn't want to stand in for eternity. Grasped meanings I'd rather not have learned. I couldn't stand in that place, that seamless junction, like my mother could, like Karen could. I couldn't abide it. It hurt too much. I could never be whole like them. Rhonda grabbed Larry's arm and piloted him toward the door. Dana leaned closer. "If you ever lay a hand on my friend again or do anything to that baby, I'll rip your eyes out!" Rhonda reversed her engines and pulled Larry back in while Hal ushered our side out to the hall. He barely had a moment to put his briefcase down on one of the wooden benches before Rhonda opened the door crack and motioned to him. "I'll be right back," he said. "I think I need to," said Bobby, then collapsed onto a bench. Dana and I moved in on either side while Trish went to get a cup of water. "I'm all right," Bobby pushed her thick waves back in place. "I just got a little lightheaded. We didn't eat." She threw her arms around me. "Oh, Kim," she whispered, "I'm so glad Dana said that. I'm so glad she said that." Her voice was ragged. "I couldn't have done it." On the other bench, the next pair up stared at us. Both of their lawyers wore cowboy boots. Dana turned. "Entertainment, no extra charge," she beamed at them, adjusting her mink hat.